Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two topics and three interviews today. First, May Nye and Avi Chomsky will talk about the history of U.S. immigration policy. And then Joel Whitney will talk about the CIA and the Cultural Cold War with an emphasis on the Paris Review. We lead with two interviews that put Trump's immigration decree into historical perspective. First, May Nye. She is a professor of history and Asian American studies at Columbia. She's the author of, among other things, Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens in the Making of Modern America. May Nye.
We've been hearing a lot of commentary about the Trump immigration policies, people saying things like, this is not who we are. In fact, it has been who we are for much of our history, hasn't it?
It's who some of us are, but it's not who everybody is.
But our policies, I'm talking about.
Our policies have also changed over time. You know, we basically had an open door until World War I, with the exception of the Chinese. But you could also say the Chinese were the exception that proves the rule. Outside of Chinese and other Asians, the door was practically wide open until the First World War. And it's only since the 1920s that we've had a restrictive regime of immigration.
You say the Chinese were the exception that proved the rule. How is that?
Well, Chinese were the only group in our history that were actually singled out by name for exclusion from immigration. But that exclusion was in the context of an otherwise completely open system where basically anybody who showed up got in. You know, they turned away 1% of the people who showed up at Ellis Island during its peak years. There were some regulations, but it was not based on the country you came from. It was not based on race. Those were exclusions that I think probably you could argue over them in a modern context, but they had to do with if you had a disease or if you had a criminal background or if you were suspected that you wouldn't be able to work. So if you got off the boat at Ellis Island and you had a limp, they might think you couldn't work. But even people who limped were admitted. I mean, as I said, they denied entry to 1% of the people who showed up. So that was a system of individual selection, not categorical restrictions or exclusions based on the nation of origin or on your race.
What produced the Chinese exclusion?
Chinese exclusion, I think, needs to be understood in the context of the expansion of the United States across the continent to the West Coast and a philosophy that we call manifest destiny, which is basically that God gave white people the continent, and anybody else who was in the way should just get out of the way or be excluded from coming. And during the California Gold Rush, people came to California from all over the world, including China, but also from South America, from Mexico, from Europe. And Latinos were also not welcome during the Gold Rush, and many of them were forced out. But the American gold miners also didn't like Australians. They didn't like French people. You know, they were generally indiscriminate in their nativism, and they drove many miners away. But the charge against the Chinese stuck more than with other groups, in part because they could say they were heathens, they spoke a language that was utterly unintelligible, et cetera, et cetera. So the Chinese were seen as a threat to the security of the country. You know, it was that they took all the gold back to China. Well, everybody took gold home with them. It wasn't just the Chinese who did this. But there was a particularly kind of virulent racism against the Chinese. But it still took decades to get a national law passed to exclude Chinese, even though there was a racist movement in California against the Chinese, something that a lot of people would recognize today, you know, in terms of violent attacks on people on the streets, local laws against them, lynchings, all kinds of things. But it wasn't until 1882 that the Western states were able to get Congress to pass a law excluding Chinese from the country.
And how long did that stand?
That was repealed in 1943, and that was a geopolitical wartime measure. China was an ally of the United States during the war, and Japan, who was the enemy, made a lot out of the fact that the United States excluded Chinese and other Asians in its own bid to win over the other Asian countries. So it was embarrassing to the United States. But what's important to note here is that when Congress repealed the exclusion laws, it didn't really want more Chinese to come. It set a quota of 100 a year. So you can see, you know, the political reasoning, but also the real intent, which was not to let more Chinese come into the country. So it wasn't until 1965 when the national origin quotas, the differential quotas were repealed, that Chinese were able to come in larger numbers.
And then what produced the nativist turn of the 20s?
The 1920s, but at one level it was a culmination of nativist agitation against the Europeans from Italy and Russia, Poland, etc. That had been going on for 20 years. But they also were not able to get national legislation. In fact, they got Congress to pass a requirement that anybody entering the country had to pass a literacy test. And that was vetoed four times before they were able to override the last veto. So there was a very active nativist movement throughout the first two decades of the 20th century. But with World War I, there was a change in the political climate. There was a lot of work done on the part of the government to get people to support the war by painting Germans in very ugly ethnic, you know, strokes. So there was a big anti-German movement during the war, which forced Germans to really give up a lot of their ethnic identifiers. You know, a lot of people changed their names. They closed down the German language newspapers. So the German Americans really kind of got deracinated during World War I. And then after the war, that nationalistic sentiment combined with the Red Scare, fear of Bolshevism, fear of anarchism, all these isms, un-American isms were associated with foreign-born people. So those two things converged, right? A long time nationalist and nativist movement combined with war hysteria and combined with post-war reactionary politics. All those things came together in the 1920s.
Then how does the current discourse around Muslims echo or not previous nativist uprisings?
I think it's very similar. It's an anti-religious sentiment, obviously, but I think it's also very racist. You know, it's kind of, you could say religion's the new racism in some sense. And it's stoked by these appeals to national security in the same way that immigrants from Eastern Europe in the 1910s were associated with foreign ideologies that were seemed to be threatening, like anarchism or Bolshevism. So Muslims are associated with terrorism. And most rational thinking people would understand that not all Muslims are terrorists, and not all terrorists are Muslims. But this is a very easy kind of sloganeering that combines with racial hostility towards brown people, even though not all Muslims are quote-unquote brown, right? They come from all different backgrounds. So, you know, I think a lot of Americans don't really understand what Islam is about. They don't understand who Muslims are. It's been painted into a very scary thing. And, of course, we're all concerned about terrorism. But this is the worst way to go about combating terrorism, because you paint a whole group as terrorists, and that just leads to all kinds of misunderstandings. It leads Muslims to not trust the government, right? So a lot of local law enforcement agencies actually are very worried about this kind of thing, because if you smear a whole immigrant group, then just basic public safety becomes more a problem, because people won't go to the police and report a problem. So, and it doesn't really do anything to stop terrorism. In fact, it gives the terrorists an excuse to say, you see, America hates us. Sad all the way around.
Do you see any logic behind the seven countries that were named and excluding Saudi Arabia and Indonesia? Does this make any sense, or should we try to make sense of it?
Well, I think it's very strategic and calculated. I mean, a lot of people are saying that this executive order was very badly written, which it was, and that it's incompetent, which it is in some ways. But it's actually, in some ways, it's very clever. First of all, those seven countries are not the countries that have generated terrorists. So we have to understand that. So if the idea really is to prevent terrorists from coming to countries, picking those seven countries makes no sense. But it does make sense from other points of view. First of all, as some people have pointed out, Trump has business dealings in countries with large Muslim populations, like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. So there's a question of his conflicts of interest on a business level. But also, I think beyond Trump's individual corruption, there are also American foreign relation issues that would be far more consequential if they banned everybody from Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Turkey or Pakistan, right? That has a far higher cost in terms of American foreign relations and also American commercial interests, oil, for example. So that's at that level. And third, by not naming all countries with Muslim populations, they can say this is not aimed at Muslims because, look, we've excluded, you know, all these other countries. Where they're very clever is that hidden in that executive order is another provision that says that all immigrants or prospective immigrants coming to the United States, regardless of their country of origin, are now going to be subject to what they call enhanced standards to make sure that people are fit to be admitted. And that will require now a personal interview, and some of that is ostensibly to determine fraud. But also, the language says they want to make sure that people coming to the United States will positively contribute to America. Now, that's a very subjective standard. How would you determine if somebody is potentially a positive contributor to America? So you can just imagine Europeans sailing through their interviews, Christians sailing through their interviews, and Muslims facing interrogations that they could never prove that they love America because the default assumption is that they don't love America. And in fact, Trump even said when he signed the order, we only want people here who deeply love America. Deeply love America. What is that? And that's supposed to apply to tourists too, right? Why would we expect a tourist who comes to the United States or a businessman who comes to the United States to do short-term business? Why would we expect them to love America? This is how they can get all Muslims without saying they're going to get all Muslims. And this is what they did during the Chinese Exclusion Act. Chinese came who were admissible because they were a citizen of the United States or they had certain categories that were exempt, like merchants. They faced horrible interrogations. Sometimes it went on for months. And this is the specter, I think, that we have. So even though the ban is only aimed at seven countries, they have ways, and I think they are very smart to put in these provisions because now they can use a subjective interview to say, oh, well, that person, I don't think that person deeply loves America.
I don't think I would pass that test. Finally, yeah. Any lessons from history on how we might fight this horrible thing?
Well, I think the protests are really important. I think the Democrats in Congress have to stand up to this, and Republicans can stand up to it too. But, you know, in the end, you know, it's really the immigrants themselves who make the difference. You know, the debate, the fight isn't just between Americans who are pro and Americans who are anti-immigration. The immigrants are also part of our population. And one of the wonderful things about this country is that anybody who's born here is a citizen. So the children of immigrants who can vote, you know, they make a big difference. So Obama won two elections in large part with big Latino turnouts and Latino votes. And the Latino vote was not as, it was still very high, and it went overwhelmingly for Clinton against Trump. I mean, Trump won this election with very narrow margins in a few states, right? And we know he didn't win the popular vote. So there are a lot of issues as to why he won. But the Latino vote is still an important factor in American politics. So, and it's also in part why there is a lot of public support for immigrants is because many Americans know immigrants, right? I mean, citizens are neighbors with immigrants, they're coworkers. You know, they're my students in my classrooms. So I think this is in the end what makes a difference is the factor of the immigrants themselves. And it'll take time because obviously we've had a big setback with this administration. and hopefully with more resistance and political pressure, we can turn that back around. But it'll be hard.
That was May Nye, professor of history and Asian American studies at Columbia. And now another historian of immigration, Avi Chomsky. She is a professor of history and coordinator of the Latin American Studies program at Salem State University in Massachusetts, and is the author of several books in immigration. Avi Chomsky. How does this Trump immigration ban strike you in a historical context? Is this precedented, unprecedented?
It's very, very precedented. And in some ways, it's horrifying and shocking, and it's wonderful to see the depth and breadth of the protest and response that it has evoked. But in other ways, it's not really that different from what has been deeply established in U.S. immigration law and reiterated over and over and over again. That is, the United States has never had a generous policy towards refugees. It's true that there's a significant number of refugees who have now been approved for entry into the United States who have now, with this new order, been put into limbo. They can't come. So there is a significant number of people who are deeply harmed by this. And also, of course, people who have green cards or different kinds of visas who've already been approved for entry. But most people who want to come to the United States, who are refugees, who deeply need to flee or are in the process of fleeing or have fled their homes and want to come to the United States, already can't do it. That is, we're talking really here about a very small minority of would-be immigrants. So most would-be immigrants are already banned from coming to the United States. And this new ban only expands slightly. I mean, it is extravagant to say, well, the small number of people who have already gotten through the existing bans and are permitted to enter now, they're not allowed to enter either. But we shouldn't think that prior to this, anybody who was a refugee could come to the United States, or anybody who wanted to study in the United States or work in the United States could come. We're talking about a very select group of people who had already made it through all of the existing bans and had been approved for entry. That's who this order affects.
So let's go back into history. I imagine in the 19th and early 20th centuries, at least the image is that you could pretty much just walk in here. Is that fair?
I would say, and if you'll permit me, I'm going to go back even a little bit before the 19th century. That is, if you were white, you could just walk in here. If you go all the way back to the American Revolution and look at the Declaration of Independence and look at what the colonists are protesting when they demand political independence from Britain, they want more white immigration. And they want more white immigration because they're trying to create a white country. And the flip side of this wanting more white immigration is they want more freedom from the British to take Native American land. So this has been a country of immigration, white immigration, and deportation of people of color from its very founding, and it's right there in the Declaration of Independence. This is a country of white immigration and the deportation of people of color. And this has, in fact, been written into U.S. citizenship and immigration law all along. Obviously, citizenship was restricted to white people. And I just want to say something about the term immigrant, too, because immigrants were considered to be white people and only white people. Immigrants are people who come to this land with the potential for becoming citizens. And because only white people could become citizens, only white people were immigrants. Other people who came involuntarily, I should add, that is, people of color were forcibly brought to this country during the first 100 years, prior to independence and during the first many decades after independence, but they were not considered immigrants because they were not allowed to become citizens. So it's not until after the Civil War that citizenship is opened up beyond white people, and it's done through citizenship by birth. That is, citizenship is granted to anyone except Native Americans who is born in this country. It's then that Congress starts putting restrictions on immigrations, and these are racial restrictions, and they're very clearly implemented to prevent non-white people from coming to the United States now because they do not want them to be able to obtain citizenship by birth. So the restrictions on immigration are, yes, immigration is open for white people, but it's not open for people of color. Once people of color can obtain citizenship by birth, then they're not allowed to come anymore. And this is applied primarily at first to Asians, to Chinese, and in the 1880s, and then starting in the 1870s, really, right after citizenship by birth is implemented in 1868. And then Asians being classified as aliens ineligible to citizenship, Asia grows and grows and grows until it covers over half of the world's territory is defined as Asia, and people from all of those places are not allowed to come to the United States because they are aliens ineligible to citizenship. So what you said, open immigration for white people until the 1920s, yes, but closed for people of color. And deportation of people of color is also really built into the DNA of the country. So I just want to say one more thing about how Mexicans were treated during this whole period. Because while Asians were being excluded, cheap labor was needed, especially in the South and Southwest, Southwest and West, that is. And once Asians started to be excluded, Mexican labor was even more necessary. So yet a third system was set up for Mexican workers. Europeans, welcome. Asians, prohibited. Mexicans, imported and exported, imported and deported. So the deportation regime that began with deporting of Native Americans is quickly expanded to the deportation of Mexicans. Mexicans are invited into work. They're recruited deep inside Mexico through the 19th and 20th centuries, but with the caveat that they are deportable workers, unlike Asians who are harder to deport because they come from farther away. So the idea is that Mexicans are not immigrants. They are deportable workers. They're brought into work and then deported.
What about the rest of the Southern Hemisphere?
The immigration law applies equally to the entire Southern Hemisphere. But in fact, until late in the 20th century, it's primarily overwhelmingly Mexicans that we're talking about. And the recruitment programs are focused exclusively on Mexico. So the stream of Mexican migrant labor that is motivated by U.S. recruitment efforts, that focuses on Mexico.
In the light of the history of U.S. immigration policy, how does this Trump order strike you? Is it an innovation or is it just a repetition with a difference?
I guess it's both. It's innovation in that it is banning people who have already been approved. So, and I should say that after the 1960s, in 1965, this restrictive immigration system was changed that I have been describing so far, like the tripartite system of welcome for Europeans, closed doors for Asians, and deportability for Mexicans. This is changed in 1965. And it's replaced with a new regime that does almost the same thing, but under different terms, less discriminatory language and less discriminatory looking laws. So the post-1965 system grants a uniform quota by country. Every country in the world gets a shot at 20,000 immigrant visas. And these immigrant visas are allocated by close family relationships and employability status, certain employment categories is basically how these are doled out. In addition to this immigration policy, there's also a refugee policy, which is somewhat different. And the refugee policy, likewise, until the 1980s, from World War II until the 1980s, U.S. refugee policy explicitly defined refugees as refugees from communism. So no matter what you were fleeing from, if it wasn't communism, you could not gain refugee status in the United States. This has been changed in the 1980s. President Carter brings U.S. refugee law into line with international refugee law, but Congress still puts a numerical limit on the number of refugees that are allowed into the United States. So each individual refugee has to compete for a spot. A very low number of refugees compared to the number of refugees in the world, and then they have to be individually approved. So that we have an exclusivist immigration law, refugee law, and system is not new. But the one thing that is new is now turning away people who have already made it through this incredibly exclusivist system and have permission to be here.
That is, you mean that people, even with green cards, are not being allowed back in?
Well, that's actually, there's been several shifts on that, and it's still not completely clear. Initially, the White House said that people with green cards were included in this order, so they're not allowed in. Then they backtracked. That's one of the things that the court cases have challenged, and some airports and airlines are still imposing it, so it's very up in the air right now. But I was referring to people with refugee status, people who have already been approved, who have already made it through the incredibly difficult system and been one of the very few lucky ones to actually be approved for refugee status. That's what I was referring to.
What lessons from history would you offer on how to fight this thing?
I feel like there are so many things happening right now, and a lot the encouraging thing is that we're seeing a lot of mobilization right now. A lot of people, I think, are really upset by things that are happening in so many different areas. But the frightening thing is that things are happening in so many different areas, and people are feeling like, oh, well, should I be worrying about climate change, or should I be worrying about the immigration order, or should I be worrying about what he's going to do tomorrow? I think one of the lessons is that spontaneous, immediate reactions like street protests are very important, but they're not enough. That is, if we're really going to fight what's going to be a long fight, we need much deeper planning, strategizing, organizing, building organizations that in some ways we're in a very different historical space now that requires, that's certainly motivating a lot more reaction. But in some ways, what we're facing is really not all that different. Like, we should have been just this upset under the Obama regime. We should have been just this upset about the wars that Obama had been carrying out in these same countries from which refugees are now banned. That is, if we had prevented those wars, ended those wars, we wouldn't be facing this influx of refugees now. We should have been just as upset about Obama's deportation regime and his private prison regime. We should have been just as upset about the anti-immigrant legislation passed by the Clintons in the 90s. Bill Clinton, but both Clintons. So in some ways, I think that it's good that more people are being mobilized now and that a lot of us are more upset now than we were before. But in some ways, it's a mistake to see this as such an aberration, and the kind of organizing we need to do for change is the same as what we needed to be doing before, because in many ways, this is a continuation of the kinds of policies that were established by Democratic administrations.
That was Avi Chomsky, a professor of history at Salem State in Massachusetts and author of several books on immigration. It will surprise few regular listeners that I greatly appreciate her point about the continuity between Trump and his predecessors, Democrats included. But I also don't want to discourage people from mobilizing. The massive demonstrations over the last couple of weeks, the expanding displays of solidarity, and the creeping radicalization of liberals, at least some of them, have all been very inspiring. If this continues, maybe something good could come out of this Trump wretchedness. That old slogan, an injury to one is an injury to all, looks to be taking on fresh meaning. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Arise, ye whips, from your slumber. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of Kant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race.
That was some of Alistair Hewlett's version of the Internationale.
And now back in time to the Cultural Cold War of the 50s and 60s, during which the CIA ran a vast propaganda operation through front groups like the Congress for Cultural Freedom and the National Student Association, which Gloria Steinem worked for a while, although it annoys her when that's pointed out. Joel Whitney, one of the founders of Guernica, a magazine of art and politics, is just out with Thinks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers, a joint publication of Orr Books and Counterpoint Books. Joel Whitney.
The CIA's involvement in the Cultural Cold War has been widely known, but you developed some new material here, a considerable amount of new material, particularly around the Paris Review. Give us a story, the founding of the Paris Review and its early relations with the Central Intelligence Agency and its satellite operations.
The material that was not new about the Paris Review was very vague, and it centered on Peter Matheson's having been outed in a 1977 New York Times article as having worked once in counterintelligence for the CIA. The story then went that he quit before any CIA influence could actually work its way into the magic that was the Paris Review. Allegedly, the dates were always fudged, but it seemed to me like he was implying that he went over there in 1950 with CIA sponsorship, having been a foreign exchange student before that. And he worked, you know, he always said 2 years, meaning that by 52 or 53 he would have been done, and that's 53 is when the Paris Review launched. So, you know, presumably it came out, he had to deal with it. If he actually was a counterintelligence agent, he probably would have had to sign something promising secrecy. So his way of dealing with it was that it kept coming up. He didn't like to have to answer it. But then it came back around via Amy Humes's film about her dad, Doc Humes, who becomes sort of the wise eccentric in my book. He found out in 1966 when he was starting to have trouble with paranoia and worrying about the state of American politics. And he had some family trouble, and his wife left him. And in that state, Matheson showed up to confess his early ties to the CIA. And to, I think the point of that visit was to say that it was well over. And so it was sort of like maybe an acknowledgement that there were people close to him who were part of that, what was what's sometimes called the wilderness of mirrors, that world of spooks and paranoia and not being able to trust your friends and family. And so Amy Humes picks this note up in her film about her dad called Doc, and she recorded both Plimpton and Matheson talking about his CIA ties. And I guess she showed it to, this is sort of how I take the story forward from where Emmy had it. This film comes out in 2008. It's shown on PBS. It gets some attention in places like the New York Times. It's a chance for the New York Times to sort of recount this history of possible CIA ties. What I found was that there was a lot that she cut out of the film for narrative reasons, and it gets into the details for the first time, I think, of what Matheson had done for the CIA, how he was trained, who was at the top of his chain of command. I think what he says in the film is pretty minimal. He ends up getting juxtaposed with Plimpton's response. Behind-the-scenes stuff is kind of interesting to me, and she showed it to Matheson after Plimpton had died, and I think Plimpton's voice of teasing, saying, it was the worst conceivable therapy, that really irked Matheson, and he tried to retract as much as he could. He'd signed a release, but he just wanted to minimize that stuff, and we can understand why. That was one thread. There are two more threads that deal with Plimpton's ties through the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And those ties I put in this category of magazines that were considered sort of the clearinghouse, the publishing clearinghouse, the official magazines that the CIA created by the Congress, you know, via the Congress for Cultural Freedom. These magazines were, you know, funded and run by CIA people and CIA agents and CIA-sponsored editors. It would have been clear to them what the purpose was. Anti-Americanism was sort of intolerable. There were different strategies for dealing with it on one hand. And on the other hand, this idea that you could be sort of neutral or that you could despise both of the major superpowers was the other side of it that they were trying to navigate. They came up with an idea for a conference, some of these operators in the American Congress for Cultural Freedom called the American Committee. And this was a formal list of people they invited and wanted to invite to this big conference who could be seen as reliable anti-communists who, you know, on sort of the actionable side of it would be requested and often required to just sort of mass syndicate articles that made the American foreign policy point of view more clear, that made American cultural achievements clear. And every reputable little magazine and literary magazine, and in some cases mass market magazines that you could think of, were targeted on that list. The list was created before the Paris Review was actually an entity, but if you look at the history of the Paris Review in the mid to late 50s into the early 60s and into the mid 60s, it was acting as part of the clearinghouse. It was syndicating out its big author interviews with mostly white, mostly male American and European authors to sort of underscore this idea of the great freedom of American and European writers. So that was Plimpton's role. And then I found what Plimpton presided over is sort of another partial role, which was a shared editor at the Paris Review in the Paris office, working simultaneously with the Paris Review and the Paris headquarters of the Congress for Cultural Freedom. That was another sort of tie under Plimpton that the book gets to. And then finally, there was maybe the most tangential and also the most sort of militaristic tie through a founding managing editor, John Train, who was doing propaganda work in Afghanistan. His ties went back, of course, to the very beginning as a founder of the Paris Review, as a roommate of, I believe a roommate of, or at least a friend in college of Plimpton. He had done some work that seemed like he was helping create shell companies. One author has found a shell company that ultimately pointed back to him in the, I believe, the late 50s, based in the Caribbean, which was helping, you know, the CIA do whatever it had to do in the Caribbean. There would have been no shortage of activity then. But in his archives, I found these letters that showed him very actively working in what some people call media politics, or sort of a spy mission on the media propaganda in Afghanistan. And the goal was simply to catch the Soviets committing war crimes on camera. That was one of the big goals, and it was sort of thought of as this is going to be the Vietnam for the Soviets. And so that's the third big tie between the Paris Review and the intelligence community.
Let's go back to the 50s when the CIA was very actively prosecuting its cultural Cold War. And it may strike someone looking at the CIA today of, you know, Mike Pompeo, CIA, as odd that the CIA would be so interested in small circulation literary magazines like the Paris Review. And, you know, even things like abstract expressionism, which you don't really talk about in the book, but, you know, they were all over that, too. What was the CIA's idea of interfering in all this high-domed activity?
I think when you talk about the CIA, you have to talk about sort of its broader... when you talk about this CIA, the cultural CIA, there was the cohort that came out of the OSS and World War II who, while tolerating the Soviet Union as an ally, were also sort of eyeing the pivot to fighting them because they were very well versed in Stalin's tactics and his show trials and his repressions. So they had one foot, as the war was winding down, they had one foot in sort of the next game. And some of them did become CIA guys, and some of them became State Department guys, and some of them became journalists. But they had this heroic sense of having won World War II through spying and through all kinds of things. They just thought the threat had gotten so much worse because it was so much more insidious in terms of the possibility of sympathies, and the possibility of sympathies being being able to piggyback on culture. This was what drove some of these guys nuts. So they thought, you know, it's basically a version of what we now call soft power. They thought the Soviets could win the Cold War through the slippery slope via culture. And so they started to look for it. I think some of them actually wanted to have a Ministry of Culture, which is really funny. But they wanted to do it in a very pointed way to weaponize culture. They may not have all thought of it as weaponizing culture, and some of them may well have thought of it as in altruistic terms. But the way that they knew that they could make the argument went something like this. Joseph McCarthy and his cohort, the reactionaries in the American legislature, are not going to fund this. We have to do it through secret means. So you know, abstract expressionism, jazz. These were some of the things that either got funded on tours, exhibitions, and all of that stuff. I have to say, I don't find it quite as awful. And so there are some people who look at this and say, well, wouldn't it be nice to have a CIA, you know, funding the arts? We could always use more arts funding, especially when people like Trump come in and want to end arts funding. But, you know, be careful what you wish for on the literary side, because literary arts, of course, entail and encompass and are married to journalism. And when you have a secret agency presiding over your journalists in some form or another, it leads to what I find, which culminates in the Afghanistan chapter.
I'm speaking with Joel Whitney, author of Thinks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers, from Counterpoint Books. It's interesting, too, that the Paris Review took an explicitly apolitical stance, abstract expressionism, the opposite of socialist realism, also taking a very high-minded, detached-from-politics kind of stance. But they're actually pursuing a very political mission through this apolitical mask.
That was what required, I think, a whole book. I could have just left this story told partly through the Salon article that this spun off from. But it got so complicated because of that, what you just touched on. And I think one of my questions was the Paris Review apolitical publicly or outwardly, precisely so that it could take funding that would have been banned in the United States and fund a magazine aimed partly at the United States and not get caught, not draw too much attention to itself. I don't think I found any evidence of that. I think what I found more evidence of was that these friends who wanted to launch it had different politics, and I think they agreed internally. Now, mind you, while they're having these meetings, of course, many of them may not know that Matheson is a spook, which complicates it even more. But the letters that I found suggested that Plimpton was the son of sort of a rising Democratic Party lawyer and star and future UN deputy ambassador. He ran an ad for a Democratic magazine called the Democratic Digest, and they jumped down his throat. And I think the Times were sort of pre-McCarthyite and then McCarthyite, and they just didn't want to distract from the arts. It seemed like they did have Kenyon Review and these other fairly apolitical, mostly apolitical journals or outwardly apolitical journals as their model. But it did strike me as somewhat suspicious that they were doing all this soft American propaganda while proudly boasting their apolitical stance.
This is also the time of the new criticism, when they're all about analyzing texts and keeping them out of their social and political context.
Yeah, there's a writer named Michael Holtzman who's really good on that. He talks through that through several chapters, and how this was essentially the same technique that James Jesus Angleton used to figure out who could be trusted, who might be a mole. He was basically just doing close readings, and his paranoid world just didn't take at face value that he could trust what people said explicitly about their politics. So you have this obsession with what they often called ambiguous. You know, I found his politics ambiguous, and that was perhaps the worst thing you could say about someone. Interestingly, Matheson had said it about his views of Baldwin in the early to mid-50s. He found him politically ambiguous, and it turned out to be apt, because Baldwin just kept going further and further left. That was Matheson's own cover when he was asked about his CIA service. He always repeated again and again ad nauseum that he kept going left, and so the CIA was happy to accept his resignation after he wrote The Partisans. So this close reading, this would have helped the Paris Review cohort come to this idea that you could get at beauty and the belletristic sense of literature and avoid politics, and everyone would be happy.
And parenthetically, Peter Matheson's cousin, right, F.O., jumped out of a window at Harvard because he was being red-baited and gay-baited.
Yeah, I think the gay-baiting, sometimes we forget what an interesting bully sibling that was with red-baiting. And so when I first read about that, I said, oh, he wasn't really red-baited. But then I read more about the pink side of the Red Scare, and you realize that that was part of the 50s quasi-fascism. His depression, I think, played a big role, and his longtime partner had died not long before that. So depression, this is what we see with Hemingway. This is what we see with a lot of figures with mental disorders, that between the depression, between the mental disorders, and between the surveillance and the persecution, it often leads to breakdowns or suicide.
going into the 60s when all this started becoming unstuck, you write some interesting material about how it was an Operation Chaos in which the intelligence apparatus tried to disrupt the alternative press here. Could you talk some about that?
I wanted to see if it was acceptable or plausible to include that as part of this network of influence around the Congress for Cultural Freedom, because the Congress for Cultural Freedom among academics who study it, the verdict on it has been pretty narrow in terms of did it censor and did it publish good stuff or not. Well, it turns out, you know, it gets a split decision. It did publish good stuff, but it also censored. But I also wanted to see if there was any continuity between what I thought of while writing as the hard CIA, the CIA of coups and really dirty tricks, and the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And I looked at how when this, if you like, soft CIA, the cultural CIA, was outed via Ramparts and some other attention that it didn't want. I think the Ramparts story of 1964 on the National Student Association, which was a CIA front, was what set off this reaction whereby the CIA wanted to protect its secrecy. So it started mass penetrating the media. Now, a lot of journalists had already sort of been signed up through various benign and less benign means of sort of telling the CIA the anti-communist story. But this was an intense reaction to its own secrecy. It was worried about, you know, things like budget items being dropped and persecution from the executive branch or the legislative branch. And so it protected its own interests for better and for worse, and it started penetrating. First, just these riffraff, as they would have seen it, this anti-Vietnam War press, the student newspapers, but collectively that cohort was pretty sizable and pretty influential. I think one stat I saw might have estimated that they had 7 million readers or something of that order. And it's also the body through which, or the vehicle through which Seymour Hersh tells the story of My Lai, after I think Newsweek rejected that story. So to penetrate that was to penetrate essentially the free press. Whether you like reading anti-Vietnam War newspaper articles or not, at the time, it still represents an attack on the media. And I was trying to show that as kind of a slippery slope, and so show the continuity between the Congress for Cultural Freedom being funded through secrecy and this reaction. So that's what turns into Operation Chaos, and we can presume that's what turns into the much more broadly penetrated activity of Operation Mockingbird. I haven't seen the paperwork, the paper trail that ties them directly together, but we can presume it was the same sort of setup.
You end the book with John Train, who is there in the early days of the Paris Review, then operating in the 80s in Afghanistan. What was he up to there?
I think he described himself as one of the more conservative members of the original Paris Review cohort in the 1950s in Paris. And he said to me when I spoke to him that he felt that the media were too left-wing and that university professors were too left-wing. And he was on a campaign, it seemed like, to bring down the Soviets, one, and two, to sort of, it seemed to me like he was trying to find ways to pull the media to the right, or he might have seen it as pulling it to the center. But what he was actively doing was he was funding documentaries, he was liaising with people who were using, he was largely funding it, but his colleagues were using refugee relief as a cover for their sort of media spying. And what they would do, in one case, you see them plotting to embed with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a warlord who's still living, who recently changed his position from pro-ISIS to not so pro-ISIS. But this guy was part of the jihadi opposition to the Soviet invasion. And so what Train was doing was embedding with fighters trying to catch the Soviets, reacting to their skirmishes and seeing if he could get video footage of you know, they sort of sounded like they wanted to see war crimes in some of these memos. That's what John Train was doing in Afghanistan, and it sort of dovetailed with some of his work trying to get Solzhenitsyn interviews into the Paris Review of the 70s and 80s. He was still in touch with Plimpton then, but he by no means was he an editor of the Paris Review. He was sort of one of these glorious founders then, but he just comes out of that world and gets into some interesting stuff, which I thought took the story right up to Operation Mockingbird, which is where you have these camera people and news anchors and newspaper editors, and in some cases even the top brass and the publishing leadership of these newspapers who signed up with CIA secrecy to debrief, to get stories killed that they didn't like, and to have stories run that they did like.
And, of course, Train's work was promoted by another CIA guy, William F. Buckley.
Yeah, William F. Buckley wrote an article about one of Train's documentaries about KGB spies. Or Train, I don't know how active Train was on that documentary, but I think he bragged about having helped fund it in one letter that I saw. And you see the follow-up by Buckley saying, why won't they show this film in the liberal media? And, of course, not long after Buckley rose his voice, they showed it in the White House, and it became very influential.
All right, thanks a lot. I know we always want to know what they're doing now, but, of course, we can't possibly know that. Maybe 30 years from now, you or your successor will write a book.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to wait for the, we've got to wait for the FOIAs to come through.
That was Joel Whitney, author of Thinks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers, just out from OR Books and Counterpoint Books. Whitney will be in the Bay Area next week, Friday, February 10th, at 7 p.m. at Books, Inc., and the following day, Saturday the 11th, also at 7, at Point Reyes Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Four Long Years by Wire. The title is more topical than the lyrics. Till next week, bye.
Collapse of concentration.